Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so lovely to hear.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
That's a pleasure. You're brilliant. You're a brilliant interviewer. Oh,
thank you for your wonderful questions.
I really liked your questions.
You're a legend. That's beautiful.
It's best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for your lovely review. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Today I welcome Sarah Epstein, author of Small Spaces. The novel is a page-turning YA psychological thriller that will have you glued to the page. In this interview, Sarah takes us through the messy and complex process of writing a psychological thriller. I'm your host, Danny V.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for your time today. I'm really excited to speak to you about Small Spaces. It was such a page-turner for me, and it made me question everything and everyone.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me, Danny. I'm excited to talk to you about Small Spaces.
How did the idea for a young adult psychological thriller emerge? I haven't read many of them. I mean, I've seen a couple around, but it's almost another little niche genre within the YA fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really interesting that you say that, because the reason why I wrote it was because I was really craving more and more thrillers and things in YA. And you know, I was reading a lot of adult ones, and I was not only having trouble finding it in sort of the YA category, but the Australian YA category. And so I really, what really got me interested in writing one was when I picked up Rebecca James's, it was Sweet Damage, actually. It was the first one. It's not the first book that she wrote. Her first book was Beautiful Malice, but I picked up her second book, and it sucked me right in. It's a psychological thriller set in Sydney around Cammeray from memory. And I really loved it. And so that really kind of got the cogs turning for me. And I thought, I think by that stage, I was already writing YA. Small Spaces is actually my third novel. It's just the first one published. And so the first novel that I'd written was a mystery that was kind of a bit sinister with dark elements. And then my second one was just more of a coming of age sort of contemporary novel. But I was reading more and more kind of, darker books with darker content. And I just sort of was, craving more and more of it and couldn't find it. And so, I've always sort of been drawn to dark books and dark movies and dark TV shows like Stranger Things, all that sort of stuff really appeals to me. So I just, it was sort of a natural thing that I thought I might try my hand at this. And in some ways it was kind of good, I think, that I cut my teeth on these other two novels, because I think if I'd tried writing Small Spaces as my first novel, I might not have been able to achieve what I wanted to with it, because I think I probably wasn't quite at that stage yet. I could credit Rebecca James for her novels, because when I picked them up, it was kind of like this light bulb moment. And I thought, I want to write one of these.
I love hearing, especially stories about people who have written novels before and they haven't been published, and they see it as a real positive thing. And I hear people say, oh no, that first book that didn't get published, that was my apprenticeship. And I love hearing that, because it's so positive for people who are trying to write and get published.
Yeah, and it's probably also a little bit depressing if you are writing your first novel. I know when I was writing my first one and I was hearing about people who weren't published until their 10th novel, and I thought, oh God, I just want to give this away then. What's the point, but when you're writing it at the time, you're fully convinced that you're going to get this novel published. And, I did get that first novel out on submission, and, got sent around to a few agents, and a couple of publishers requested it. And it was really, it was kind of my initiation into the publishing industry. And it really, I learned so much from that experience. And, you know, never say never. I mean, one day I might rewrite that novel, you know, now mm-hmm. that I've got different skills and, you know, different interests, and I might just kind of rewrite it from the ground up and release it as a brand new novel. But it's just one of those things that, yes, had that been published now, I don't know how I'd feel about that being my debut novel. I'm really, really pleased that Small Spaces ended up being my debut. And my second novel was actually a contemporary sort of slightly humorous coming of age story. And it actually was picked up by a US agent, literary agent, and shopped around to US publishers for the best part of a year. It got requested many, many times and it fell short, and it did actually make it to acquisitions at one of the large US publishers. But in some ways I think, you know, like maybe I am happy. Well, I'm not happy that it failed, but I am happy that Small Spaces is the book that I'm sort of establishing myself with, because it is the genre that I want to write. And, you know, it excites me a lot more. And I will still write some contemporary YA novels. I really look forward to it, because in a way I kind of need to break up all these sort of dark stories with something a bit lighter. Mm-hmm. but yeah, so it is, yeah, you really do. You do have to do the work. And, you know, sometimes people write an absolute cracker for their first novel and that becomes their published debut. Didn't happen for me, but I don't regret anything. And I don't regret the experiences that I went through, because it really helped me by the time I did get offered a contract.
And how did that occur? Because I hear publishing processes, you know, they can be disappointing, as you've talked about your first two novels. How did this one get published finally?
Well, it's probably a little bit of an orthodox story compared to most people's journeys, which is, you know, they go out looking for a literary agent. When I first started writing Small Spaces, I actually did have, I was still with that US literary agent, and we were still trying to get that second novel of mine landed a contract. But at the same time, I was already working on Small Spaces. You have to start something new. You know, you've always got to have something going, because it's just depressing if all you're getting is rejections. And, you know, you're just sort of thinking, oh, I'm going to throw the game away. You know, like, I'm going to give up if I can't get this book published. But, of course, it might not be that one. It might be the next one. And so the thing with the thriller genre was that I'm not sure if it's what my former agent was expecting or not, but when I showed her the first 100 pages, you know, she didn't love it. So she sort of gave me some feedback about what she sort of wanted to see changed, and we didn't really agree on a whole lot. And so we realized that we kind of needed to part ways, because I thought she's not really going to get behind this novel, and this was something I really, really wanted to do. And incidentally, those 100 pages that are in the published novel now really haven't changed from that draft that agent saw. So, you know, I'm kind of glad I stuck to my guns, because when Walker Books Australia, who's my publisher, when Nicola Santilli, my editor, came across the book, you know, she fell in love with the first 100 pages and, you know, however many chapters she requested, and she found me. It's quite a funny story, because I was suddenly agentless, and I thought, well, I need to try and find myself another literary agent. So I started sending out queries, and I had sort of set myself up quite professionally. I'd learned a few things over the last few years, you know, just to give myself a website presence. I'd been on Twitter for years. I, you know, had a page on Facebook. I created my own website so I could put the description for my novel up there, so that if, you know, an editor or an agent stumbled across me, they had a lot of information to find out about me on my website, and also a synopsis, a short synopsis for the book. And so what happened with Nicola is that she just was – Walker Books is sort of actively acquiring – new Australian YA books, and they have something called Walker Wednesday where you can submit your novel to them. And they had not quite started Walker Wednesday yet, but Nicola was actively hunting for new Australian writers. And she literally Googled Australian YA writer and my website popped up. And so she, and it must have been literally within a week of when I first started querying small spaces, and the synopsis was there on the website. So she contacted me and she said, may I please read this? Could you send me the first 5 chapters? And so I did that. And then really quickly, within the space of a couple of days, or it could have even been 24 hours, she requested the full manuscript. And, yeah, that was where it all kicked off from there. So it was quite a different story.
Wow.
Getting my manuscript in front of Walker to what had happened with my previous novel, where I'd got it in front of a lot of different publishers via my agent and, you know, sort of nothing happened. So it was kind of meant to be. I think it was fate.
I love that, and I love listening to so many publishing stories because there's so many people that's so funny say, oh, I didn't do it the traditional way. And so I think there's this perception that everyone, you know, gets the agent and gets, you know, a publisher, but there are so many interesting stories. It's so great to hear that there are so many ways in.
Yeah, and, you know, like I think, you know, if you can get your manuscript in front of a literary agent, they love it and they want to represent you, that's a fantastic way of doing it. It didn't happen for me this time around, and I currently don't have a literary agent. But, you know, it's great because I have sort of one-on-one contact all the time with my editor. And, you know, Walker's been incredibly supportive to me. So, yeah, it's all actually worked out fantastic. But I think going the agent route is really, really good as well. You know, and a lot of people don't keep the first literary agent that they have. You know, they may sell that first book or they may not. They might part ways or they might sell a couple of books via that agent, but then, you know, they want to try something different and they decide to part ways with that agent and find somebody new. So, yeah, there's lots of different ways of getting the book out there. But Australian publishers now, you know, I think all the major publishers in Australia are sort of having these, you know, open calls for manuscripts on a certain day of the month. And, you know, it's all on their website and it's great because you can get your book in front of them without a literary agent. It just might sit in the slush pile for a while, but, you know, it just might get plucked out or it might be, you might have somebody like a super keen editor like mine, like Nicola, who is, you know, actively out there hunting for great manuscripts and, you know, and then she'll literally be proactive enough and contact you.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. Going back to the novel, I love the tension and pacing of a psychological thriller. I must say I'm a big fan of adult psychological thrillers, and that's why halfway through this novel I was like, hey, this is great because it's young adult and I would have loved this, you know, even more so as a kid or a teenager. But how do you put it all together, your ideas, the suspense, the red herrings? There's a lot to consider when you're putting together a psychological thriller.
Yeah, it's, you know, yes, there is. Yeah, it's not easy, to be honest. You know, like I have the general story idea and, you know, so you've got two main issues, I suppose, when you're approaching the novel, and that is what's going to happen, you know, what's the plot going to be about and what's the big reveal going to be or the big climax? Yeah. And then what format are you going to actually tell this story? You know, will it just be a linear story where you just get your character going from A to B? Or will it be, you know, will you use devices or non-linear narrative like small spaces, which uses now and then chapters? So you've got present day chapters and you've got flashbacks to things that have happened in the past. And then, yeah, I introduced some other elements like the therapy session transcripts that Tash, the main character, where she's chatting to her psychologist when she's a child, and also some newspaper articles, which kind of, you know, give information about the case, about something that's happened in the past, without skewing it from Tash's perspective. So it kind of gives the readers, you know, some information that's not that's not coming from Tash's point of view, so they can kind of make their own minds up about what may or may not have happened. So adding all of that is tricky. And to be honest, in some ways I do have to draw on my graphic design past because I was a graphic designer for 25 years. And so I do things quite visually sometimes. And so I actually often create big color charts and lay them all out on my desk. Some people may do this with a program like Scrivener or something like that. I just use Word when I write manuscripts, but I do like to lay things out visually. Some people use index cards and shuffle them all around. And I like to kind of color code things like chapters, characters, even pacing, you know, where something might be a bit slow, where the pacing's really fast and lots of action. And when you lay it all out, you can kind of see where you've got gaps or where you've got too much of something, and it helps you kind of move things around. So I did have to shift a lot of chapters around while I was writing the first draft, and that was mostly because a lot of the things that I was revealing in the past chapters, the then chapters, I realized I might be revealing something too soon mm-hmm. or too late. And it's just this constant juggle, and a real balancing act. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I was thinking when I was reading it, because it is, you know, a really tight narrative and it does reveal things exactly at the right time. And I thought, how does this all come together? So it's nice to hear that it was all, you know, kind of a big mess behind the scenes.
It is. And, you know, and you gradually, as you keep refining it, you know, you're noticing where something sticks out like a sore thumb, or if you've dropped a clue and it's way too obvious, you know. And so you can keep going back and just fixing those things. But it's not the kind of story that you write that you just kind of knock it out. Like I think I wrote the first, like I literally wrote the first, well, I guess the first 100 pages pretty much in the order, chapter order that it is, mm-hmm. you know. So I wrote a present day chapter, and then I wrote a newspaper article, then I wrote another present day chapter, and then I wrote a flashback chapter. And so I actually wrote those kind of in a linear way, rather than kind of writing all of the present day chapters for the book on one day.
Yeah.
And then another day I did all the newspaper articles. It wasn't like that. But what I did do with the therapy session transcripts was there would be, you know, a week or two where I would just spend time kind of writing those, refining them, trying to get the language right, and trying to figure out where I wanted to put all my reveals of information. And then I sort of slotted them into the novel and realized, oh no, I have to move that one, or I'm going to have to edit that one, or take some of the information from that one and move it, you know, to the beginning of the novel. So yeah, it is a lot of you know, kind of cutting and pasting and moving things around. But you know, then you sit back and you read the whole thing from the beginning to the end, and you can easily see where the pacing needs to change, or you know, where you've, well, I say you easily can when you've really got to put it away for a while, because when, you know, you're just reading it all the time and sometimes you need to pass it on to a critique partner, you know, or write a friend or something, and then they read it and say, oh, what's going on here? And mm-hmm. you realise you've absolutely, you know, you've taken some information out of somewhere and forgot to add it somewhere else. So, yeah.
I love how such a messy process turns into such a beautifully refined novel.
Oh, well, thank you. What a compliment.
And I loved the inclusion of the therapy sessions, the transcripts. I thought they were so great, because even though it was a type of flashback, they were all in linear order. And so you'd learn a little bit more as she got a little bit older as time went by. Yeah. So I thought they were really clever.
Well, I mean, the thing with the therapy session transcripts, the main reason why they came about was when I first started writing, I realised I wanted to, you know, sort of go back to, well, I wanted Tash thinking about the therapy sessions that she had when she was younger, but I thought, well, I don't really want her in the present day kind of sitting there lamenting about these therapy sessions, because I thought that would get quite, you know, boring for the reader, that she was just sitting there having all these thoughts, and it affects the pacing and things. And I really thought, well, I'm sure readers would much rather kind of hear or read that transcript in real time. So that was kind of how those chapters came about.
In the novel, the setting is really important, both in Aunt Ally's house and the carnival. And I thought that setting was so important, and it almost became another character in how menacing it was. Mm. And what is it about carnivals that are so creepy? Because they're meant to be for fun and for children, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always found them, you know, a little bit creepy. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, all that kind of larger than life artwork and characters and clowns and, you know, things that are all right up in your face and all the music and stuff, like even organ music, you know, that accompanies carousels and things is always, it's a little bit disturbing. You know, I think I use a line in the novel where I say that the discordant clang of the sideshow, and that's what it's like to me. It's a bit jarring, you know, but I think it's just the crowds, you know. I think that's where the potential for this idea came for with me was just, you know, I've got kids that are 11 and 13 now, but when they were younger, and they're a bit younger when I started writing Small Spaces, but when they were really young, you know, going to anywhere that's really crowded, you always just have that kind of, there's just always the potential that they're just going to kind of slip away, you know, or that they're just going to get kind of swallowed up by the crowd. And you've got, you know, you're gripping their hand and you're thinking, God, you know, they could just disappear at any minute. And so that kind of thing sort of stayed with me. And I thought that, you know, that was something that I could tap into for this. I think, you know, a derelict carnival like the one that, you know, Tash visits as a teenager is even creepier, because then you kind of, you know, just conjures up all these ideas of ghosts and, you know, creepy things and dead things and, you know, and it's deserted. So there's just nobody to help you if anything goes wrong.
And your description was just spot on, you know, when you're talking about the music and how jarring it was. I was reading it and I went, oh, this is exactly how I feel when I go to one of those things.
It's like, you know, you're there and you go, oh, I'm happy, and then there's too much music, yep. There's too much sugar, there's too much noise, there's too much, you know, sun beating down on you and too many smells, and then all of a sudden it's not fun anymore.
Yeah, you know? Yep. I think you're absolutely right. You've nailed that. Now, Mallory was such a lovely character, and it's so funny. It's the second novel in a row where I've fallen in love with a mute character. I was talking earlier about Boy Swallow's universe and the character of August Bell, and I thought, oh, there's this other beautiful kind of otherworldly character who also doesn't speak. Right. And how much characterization can you get from a character that doesn't speak? I think that is a real credit to your writing. How did you develop a character like Mallory?
Thank you. Well, I suppose with Mallory, you know, when I was writing the novel, I knew exactly what situation she'd been in when she was a child. And I had to do some research into, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder for both Mallory and for Tash. And, you know, just to see how it might affect, you know, it might affect Mallory, the things that had happened to her. I'm trying to talk without giving any spoilers. Yes. And yeah, so, you know, it was interesting because when my son, my eldest son, was about five, before he started school, just out of nowhere, he sort of developed a stutter, and we took him to a lot of speech therapy and we did all sorts of exercises with him. And it was really interesting to see him, you know, blocking on words and really wanting to talk and not being able to get the words out. And, you know, there's all this different psychology behind it and why it happens. And, you know, with Mallory, she has, you know, traumatic mutism. So she is, you know, she's been traumatized and she really does want to talk, but she can't get the message from her brain to her mouth to actually form the words. So she blocks on these words. And so, yeah, it was really interesting just thinking about how she communicated, you know, what it was like for her. You know, she was homeschooled, how she kind of communicated with the outside world, you know, having friends online and things like that, which is, you know, a hell of a lot easier than her having to go out and try to communicate. Even the way she communicates with her brother at home and things, you know, just shooting text messages to each other and stuff like that, they kind of adapted to a way that made her comfortable. So, yeah, it was, you know, it's funny because a few readers have said to me that they would love to have had more of Mallory in the book, and so would I. It just would have made it 100,000 word tome, you know, to add that in. But you know, I love that people just were fascinated and intrigued by Mallory, because you know, her story is very important in the novel. And I don't think I can say anything else without spoiling.
Yeah, she was a beautiful character. She was empathetic and, you know, very mysterious, and that's and vulnerable too, I think. And I think that's what draws the reader in.
And also, she did have some moments of attitude as well, yes, you know. So, you know, she's got some fight in her. And, you know, and I think that she and Tash, in other circumstances, if the Fisher family had stayed in the town and she'd grown up with Morgan and his sister only 2 years younger, I think they probably would have become really firm friends, you know. So I think, I think Mallory is, even by the end of the story, there is a whole other story for Mallory there. You know, it's interesting to imagine what might have happened with her going forward, I think, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also really nice in the novel, even though obviously it's a psychological thriller and we're looking at the reveals and what's happening here, but there are other issues throughout the novel too, which I think are really important, especially for young adult readers. And one of them was Sadie and being in a same-sex relationship was just embedded into the story. And I thought that was a really nice way to do it.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, I I think that I just like to have a very realistic reflection of, characters of society, really. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's just how Sadie came to me. It was easy to just write her in. And, you know, I suppose that's the thing is that, it's not meant to be a big deal about Sadie's sexuality.
Yeah.
Also other characters in the novel, you know, different nationalities and things like that, you know, it's just all, I just wanted it to be a very natural reflection. And I think I'm reading more and more novels myself in YA that are like that, where, you know, it's not a really big deal to kind of be making it more diverse. I mean, there are some novels that are very diverse and they're fantastic, but I love reading novels now where you are just seeing all sorts of different diverse characters just, popping into the character cast as they should. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I loved how Sadie didn't fit into any stereotype. Her Maori background, liking girls, I just thought it was so great. And she was such a spirited, supportive, lovely character.
Yeah, she's actually was one of my favourite characters to write. I mean, I've got a soft spot for all of my little gang.
Of course you do.
but, you know, Sadie is just a lot of fun. And, you know, she's not without her flaws as well. And, you know, there's a few tense moments with her friendship with Tash. And, you know, so it's not like everything – she's not perfect or anything, but she is just a – you know, she's a real kick-ass friend. And, you know, she's just somebody that I think – I would like to think that, you know, most people would like to know and have in their lives. And so, you know, Tash is really fortunate in that regard.
And it also brings up, issues of friendship and bullying and mental illness and even some people's responses, Rachel Tan's lack of empathy and understanding for what, you know, Tash is going through.
Mm.
And at the end, I really like how she says, we all share the fundamental need to be heard, to know we matter, because at the centre of the book, that's what it's about, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, it's funny when you write these novels that you're not really writing them thinking, oh, I'm going to write a book about this theme. You know, the themes sort of come to you as you're writing and you get sort of towards the end of the book and you think, oh, yeah, that's what I was saying. You know, that's what I was trying to say all along. And it's, you know, it was an opportunity for me to be able to kind of condense that into a succinct thought that Tash was having. And, you know, then I realised that it actually affected every single one of the characters that I'd written about in the novel, even down to, you know, Tash's mum, who is, you know, like everybody despises. But, you know, even she just kind of wants to be heard. You know, it's just one of those things where, you know, just the relationships and having the characters connecting and the theme just sort of revealed itself to me. And I thought, yes, okay, that's really what I was trying to say with this novel. And it was the sort of thing that I really felt as a teen, you know, you'd lie in bed at night and just think, God, does anyone even care, you know, that I exist? You know, does anyone even listen?
Yeah.
And, you know, and just wanting that connection with other people and feeling like you do matter.
Yeah, I think that's why it resonates with the readers too, because like you say, it sort of ties that feeling up and you can relate that back to every single character, whether they're a villain or our heroine or whoever.
And also, you know, I think that's why Small Spaces sort of has a bit of a crossover appeal with the readership, you know, from not just teens enjoying it, but a lot of adults mm-hmm. are telling me that they've read it and they're really enjoying it. And I think it's just because it touches on things that, you know, that everybody can relate to. You know, it's not like I've written something that's only teen-centric.
Yeah, universal.
You know, it's sort of a... Yeah, it's a story that I think that that adults do relate to on some level, whether it was from when they were a teen or just now, you know.
And so many adults are loving YA fiction. It's so diverse. It's so beautifully written. It's so interesting. I was saying to someone else, I think they're going to have to change the name of the genre from young adult fiction to something else.
Well, you know, primarily we still write, you know, YA authors, we are writing for teens. You know, like when I wrote this, I was writing it for teens and I wasn't really thinking, oh, you know what, I'll make it dark and then it'll have crossover appeal. You know, I think that was, it was just like, it's great that it does have crossover appeal. And I'm really happy that adults are reading it and enjoying it too. But honestly, when I wrote it, I was really just thinking of teen girls and boys, what I couldn't get my hands on, to be honest, at the time, because, you know, back then, there was some fantastic YA around, but in terms of YA thrillers and things, you know, there were a few, like, there was a bit of YA horror in the form of, like, Christopher Pike and things like that. And I suppose, you know, there was, like, that was the kind of books that I found or was given for a birthday once in a blue moon, and I love them. And I was like, you know, and I don't even know if I really want to reread one of them these days because I don't even know how they'd hold up. But yeah, back then it was exciting, you know, because up until then I'd been reading, you know, kind of fairly tame books and, you know, The Babysitter's Club and you know, Sweet Valley High and things like that. And then I'd read one of these horrors, you know. But then other than that, there was really only my mum's collection of horror novels that, you know, she had Stephen King and James Herbert and Dean Koontz and things like that. And so really, you know, I didn't have a lot that was sort of in between. It was like, well, I stick with these teen books or do I jump straight into that horror? And I did read some of those horror novels when I was a teen, but they were just a little bit too, you know, a bit too adult for what I was wanting.
And I remember that too. I remember reading my mum's Virginia Andrews, and I was way too young to be reading that kind of stuff. Remember those books when they were just like crazy?
Oh, yeah. My mum had one too.
And I remember reading it, and looking back, I'm like, yeah, I was far too young to be reading that. But you're looking, you know, as a teenager, you're looking for something that's a bit exciting, that's a bit, you know, it's going to make you think. But, yeah, they probably made me think a bit too much.
I think that's why I was attracted to... You know, like when I was a teenager, I used to love a slumber party with horror movies and things. And, you know, I think it's just that thrill of, you know, being able to explore dark themes and, you know, suspense and like really kind of scary stuff, but in the safety of your bedroom or your lounge room or, you know, just the safety of your own home. And I think that's why people just really enjoy thrillers, you know, and horror movies or really suspenseful reads, is just because you kind of want to go there, you know, you kind of want to read something really creepy and dark, but, you know, and that's what reading does. It just gives you sort of a safe space to explore that without you having to go out and do something drastic, you know, kind of out of the safety of your own home. So, you know, I think that maybe is what appeals to me. I find it really entertaining. I love reading a thriller. I love, you know, for me, my favourite type of book, you know, I don't mind, you know, kind of, I'm a real plot-driven reader and writer. So, for me, I love fantastic characters, but I really need a strong plot. Mm-hmm. And I like it when it really cracks along, you know, when it's real page turner. So that's really the kind of book that I want to write and create that experience for other people, because it's what I love doing myself. You know, that staying up until 3 a.m. thinking, oh, God, I'm going to regret this tomorrow, but just one chapter, you know.
Yeah, and that's exactly what that book did for me too.
Right. Well, that's perfect.
Debut novel recently released in the UK, which must be pretty exciting. Yeah. What's next for you?
Well, I am working on some more YA novels. I have to be honest, I spent about 40,000 words on what I now realise is not the novel that I want to follow up Small Spaces with. So apologies to Nicola, my editor, if she hears this.
Surprise.
What's that?
Surprise, Nicola.
Surprise. should be like, why didn't you email me? I was working on another thriller, but I think for me what it was lacking was just that that element, that hook that I think that teens really crave, that makes a book stand out from others. And, you know, for Small Spaces, it's the imaginary friend element, about not only her having an imaginary friend when she was a kid, but the imaginary friend has come back. You know, it just sort of starts creating all these questions. And I think the novel that I was working on, I felt like it was not going to prompt those kind of questions in readers. And so I had another idea, which is now the book that I'm currently working on, and I'm starting to feel that kind of drive and that fire, you know, that I did when I was writing Small Spaces. And I can't really talk too much about it or give too much away because it's still sort of, I'd like to say early stages. It's not really, like, it's moving along quite well, but I'll keep my cards close to my chest at this point. But it is another thriller with a lot of suspense and psychological elements as well. So I think it's going to be a good one to follow up Small Spaces. And then I do have another couple of YA ideas, but I do have a bit of an adult sort of domestic noir psychological thriller sort of humming away in the background, and I've been writing a few notes for it. So who knows, one day I might get the time to actually get that one down too.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to your mysterious new YA fiction.
You know, I'm trying to really figure out all the things that worked, you know, that people seem to be responding to with Small Spaces, and trying to bottle that and then create this novel from that. So we'll see how it goes.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us today on the podcast. It's a really exciting sort of niche genre within YA fiction. So thank you so much for your time.
Hey, Danny, I've really enjoyed it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.